Namaste Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. So we're reading from the Srimad Bhagavatam, Canto 8, Chapter 5, Text 50, which is the last verse of the chapter entitled The Demigod's Appeal to the Lord. Namastu Bhyamanantaya Durivitarakyatmakarmane Nagunaya Guneshaya Satvastaya Chasampratam Namastu Bhyamanantaya Durvitarkyatmakarmane Nirgunaya Guneshaya Satvastaya cha sampratam Namastu Bhyamanantaya Durvitarkyatmakarmane Nirgunaya Guneshaya Satvastaya cha sampratam Vaishnavas Namastu Vyananthaya Durvitakyatmakamane Nirgunaya Guneshaya Satvastaya cha sampratam Namastu Vyamanantaya Durvitakyatmakamane Nirgunaya Guneshaya Satvastaya cha sampratam Namastu Vyamanantaya Durvitakyatmakamane Nirgunaya Guneshaya Satvastaya cha sampratam Namastu Vyamanantaya Durvitakyatmakarmane Nirgunaya Guneshaya Satvastaya cha sampratam Vaishnavis Namastu Vyamanantaya Durvitakyatmakarmane Namastu Vyamanantaya Namastu Vyamanantaya Durvitakyatmakarmane Nirgunaya Guneshaya Satvastaya cha sampratam Namah All obeisances to Bhyam unto you, my Lord, Anantaya, who are everlasting, transcending the three phases of time, past, present, and future. Durvitarkya Atmakarmane, unto you who perform inconceivable activities, Gunaya, Nirgunaya, which are all transcendental, free from the inebriety of material qualities. Guna Ishaya, unto you who control the three modes of material nature. Sattvastaya, who are in favor of the material quality of goodness. Cha, also, Sampraptang, at present. Translation. My Lord, all obeisances unto you who are eternal, beyond time's limits of past, present, and future. You are inconceivable in your activities. You are the master of the three modes of material nature, and being transcendental to all material qualities, you are free from material contamination. You are the controller of all three of the modes of nature, but at the present, you are in favor of the quality of goodness. Let us offer our respectful obeisances unto you. Purport by His Divine Grace, Srila Prabhupada. The Supreme Personality of Godhead controls the material activities manifested by the three modes of material nature. As stated in Bhagavad Gita, Nirgunam Gunabhoktritcha, the Supreme Personality of Godhead is always transcendental to the material qualities, Sattvagun, Rajagun, and Tamagun. But nonetheless, He is their controller. The Lord manifests Himself in three features, as Brahma, Vishnu, and Maheshwara, to control these qualities. He personally takes charge of Sattvaguna as Lord Vishnu, and He entrusts the charge of Rajaguna and Tamaguna to Lord Brahma and Lord Shiva, who are both there talking to Him, by the way. He personally takes charge... Ultimately, however, he's the controller of all three gunas. Lord Brahma, expressing his appreciation, said that because Lord Vishnu has now taken charge of the activities of goodness, there was every hope that the demigods would be successful in fulfilling their desires. The demigods were harassed by the demons who were infested with tamagun. However, as Lord Brahma had previously described, since the time of Sattvagun had now arrived, the demigods could naturally expect to fulfill their desires. The demigods are supposedly well advanced in knowledge, yet they could not understand the knowledge of the Supreme Personality of Godhead. Therefore, the Lord is addressed here as Anantaya. Although Lord Brahma knows past, present, and future, he is unable to understand the unlimited knowledge of the Supreme Personality of Godhead. Thus end the Bhaktivedanta purports of the 8th canto, 5th chapter of the Srimad Bhagavatam, entitled The Demigod's Appeal to the Lord for Protection. Om Aginatamirandasya Ganangana Shalakaya Chakshur Unyavatam Jaina Tasmai Shri Gurave Namaha Mukham Kurati Vachalam Pangam Langayate Girinyat Kriptam Maham Vande Shri Gurum Tiyadharanam. So, as we come to the end of this chapter, we are not coming to the end of the story. The story goes on and on. But I thought that we could look at the lessons learned thus far and the lessons learned in the Bhagavatam in general, or the lessons learned in Shastra in general. Yesterday, Kaunteya Prabhu was talking about... I was never once told that I don't talk loud enough. Is that better? Okay. Yesterday, Kaunteya Prabhu spoke about analogies and different embellishments to an art, and the art is telling stories. And we often, in our common vernacular, and especially in America, we think of stories as kind of a waste of time or things we say to each other to, you know, to kind of keep each other entertained. But actually, traditionally, and very much in our Vedic tradition, stories are the way that we are taught. Even grandmothers teach their grandchildren by stories, by telling stories. In modern times, stories are very much told by the media. The stories we hear every day are told by the news, right, by the movies. And we hear the stories of people who are steeped in passion and ignorance. And not only are they steeped in passion and ignorance, but their desire is to steep us in passion and ignorance. And so they tell us stories. We go to college, we hear so many stories, we read so many stories. We open the newspaper. Prabhupada used to say when he opened the newspaper, he'd get a headache. Magazine, just looking at the pictures, he said, I get a headache. So, but those stories are designed, they're calculated. It's a multi-billion dollar industry, actually. They're calculated to put us in the mode of passion and ignorance. They're calculated to start up in us desires that we didn't even know we had, or we weren't even conscious we had. How many of you ever felt that you needed a hula hoop, you know, or a troll? But somehow or other, they stir up these desires in us, and then we go and buy them by the gazillions. And we do that cyclically, again and again and again. That the clothes we wear that are one color this year, next year we have to get rid of them because now they're no longer in fashion because they're the wrong color. And this whole industry tells us stories about how we should look, stories about what's sexy, stories about what's important, stories about what's prestigious. And it sells us those stories. They're in our face, all over the place, ubiquitous. And the stories of the Bhagavatam and the stories of Bhagavad Gita and the other Vedic literatures are designed for a different purpose. Actually, at the beginning of the Srimad Bhagavatam, we hear that the Bhagavatam is designed to kick out all cheating stories, all cheating information, anything that will take us in a direction different from the Supreme Personality of Godhead. Bhagavatam is designed to kick those out. So the stories in the Bhagavatam, every one of them, by the definition of the beginning of the Bhagavatam, every one of the stories in the Bhagavatam is there to teach us something, to help us go back to Godhead, which is the ultimate goal of the Bhagavatam. Bhagavatam speaks on 10 topics. I'm not going to go into them so much. But the final one, the ultimate one, is Ashraya, the Supreme Personality of Godhead, our ultimate shelter. And we know from Srila Prabhupada's instruction that information is encapsulated in the 10th canto of the Srimad Bhagavatam, where Krishna and his leelas are intimately discussed. But the way the Bhagavatam is written, these pastimes of Krishna in different ways are woven from the very, very beginning all the way to the end. The pastimes of Krishna are woven, the pastimes of his devotees are woven, the stories are molded to prepare us for entering into that leela, for going back to Godhead in this lifetime, or at least eventually, right? Because at the beginning of the Bhagavatam, we understand that Vyasadeva, when he originally started to write the Vedas or sort them out and put them into writing, he worked hard, he wrote, you know, down the four Vedas, but he was miserable. And his spiritual master, just looking at his face, said, you know, you don't look so good. You're miserable. What's up? So he said, well, I don't know what's up. And he said, well, let me tell you what's up. What's up is that your stories are not clear enough. You have muddled things so that people reading these stories, these Vedic stories, and we hear about them all the time. I know in Alachua, we're studying the 10th canto of the Srimad Bhagavatam. So we're well into the 10th canto of the Srimad Bhagavatam, and I feel often when I give class there that like I'm on a ship without a captain and a rudder, because there's no, Prabhupada's purports aren't there. And that's a little scary. I mean, the great devotees, they've written purports, and I appreciate, and Vishwanath Chakravarti Prabhu, Thakur, he's also written purports, but those purports are not like Srila Prabhupada's purports. Because Srila Prabhupada's particular intention is to speak to us and get us back to Godhead in this lifetime. Actually, Srila Prabhupada wrote a letter which I take a lot of strength from. I've read it several times at the GBC meetings and at other gatherings, where Srila Prabhupada wrote a letter to the president of India in 1957, which is long before he came to America, long before he established the International Society for Krishna Consciousness, and long before he met the hippies. But nevertheless, he is telling this president, after he praises him and thanks him for being the representative of the Supreme Personality of Godhead and reminds him of his obligation to spread the word to other living entities who might not be as fortunate as he to be born in Bharatvasa. He's asking him, help me in my mission, because I have the formula. I have the formula for every man and woman to go back to Godhead in this lifetime. And Prabhupada says that in the letter 4 or 5 times. I have the formula for every man and every woman in the world to go back to Godhead in this lifetime. That's quite a formula, right? He's got that formula. And he put that formula into these books, into his Bhaktivedanta purports. And so the stories that we hear in Srila Prabhupada's books, in Srila Prabhupada's Bhagavatam, they are crafted specifically with the intention of inspiring within us the knowledge, the realization, the purity of purpose that we need to achieve spiritual perfection in this lifetime. No messing around. Right? You notice that Prabhupada translated his books in a specific order, and it was dictated to some extent by his health and by other circumstances at the beginning of the Hare Krishna movement. When I first became a devotee, we didn't have any books except for the first 3 volumes of the Bhagavatam that Srila Prabhupada brought with him from India. And then gradually Prabhupada started to translate. Well, he had to work on Gita because his manuscript got stolen, and that's a whole saga too. And then, you know, it got translated in part by Vingbilan, and then purports were taken out, et cetera, et cetera. But when I first started to come to the temple, there was only Easy Journey to Other Planets in mimeograph form, and I bet if I asked you what a mimeograph is, 90% of the people in this room have not a clue. But anyway, it's a crude way of the precursor to Xerox, I guess, right? So mimeograph form, Easy Journey to Other Planets, after a little while, a chopped up version of Bhagavad Gita and the 3 volumes of the first canto of the Srimad Bhagavatam. Then he started to translate the second canto of the Bhagavatam, and it came out in little books, and those little books would fall apart on contact. As soon as you opened them up, they would become a folder with pages inside. And then Srila Prabhupada started to get ill, and he saw in front of him danger. And so he thought, well, you know, I have to give them the 10th canto of the Srimad Bhagavatam. Because if I don't, and they enter into the waters of the 10th canto of the Srimad Bhagavatam without me holding their hand, there's every chance they're going to blow it. And even with him holding our hand, sometimes we blew it. Or we continue to blow it, I should say. I shouldn't really use the past tense. But if you look at the 10th canto of the Srimad Bhagavatam, what you see is the stories of the Bhagavatam, but they're woven with the Bhaktivedanta purports, and you can't get them out. There's no way. They're not separated into verse and purport. They're woven in there. So you can't read the stories without reading the purport. And I know that sometimes in reading the Bhagavatam and reading the Bhagavad Gita, we do that. We read the verses and we leave out the purports. Right? Because it goes faster and you get more continuity. But you miss one thing. You miss Srila Prabhupada's enlightenment and clarity in what these stories are about, why they're being told to us. Okay, what's such a big deal about Indra, you know, taking a garland and throwing it to his elephant? So what? And so many different layers of this story. Krishna will incarnate multiple times to fulfill this lila, right? He does multiple interventions here in this lila. He comes first on the back of Garuda, and he moves the mountain, and then, well, first they go to him, right? They go to Krishna, and they ask him, what are we supposed to do now? We blew it. And so looking at the story, there's many, many lessons to learn. And as we continue going through this story, we will find many, many lessons. This is in the eighth canto of the Bhagavatam. We're almost at the tenth canto, right? Where Krishna is bringing us systematically closer and closer and closer to the understandings and the foundational principles that we need to be able to enter into the 10th canto of the Bhagavatam and feel comfortable there or get the essence of that message and not get too familiar, not get confused, not get deviated, not make a mistake. So we can remain fixed and we can achieve perfection. 9th canto of the Bhagavatam, just before we get to the 10th canto, we hear about Lord Ram, right? And Lord Ram, he's a little bit easier to accept as God. The conception that we have in the Western world of God, Lord Ram, he's, you know, he's a good guy. He doesn't break any laws. He does everything just right. He's a king. He's rich. He's beautiful. He's, you know, he kills the demons and he keeps a straight path. But Krishna's path is not quite as straight. And some of the activities he does are a little bit difficult for us to understand. And so Krishna and Prabhupada lead us there very cautiously, very cautiously. So I'd like to take a couple of minutes and look to this story that we're hearing here in this part of the Bhagavatam so far, just so far, and understand what the messages are, what we understand. First, we see that we're hearing about the manus, the manvantara aspect of the Bhagavatam. And on they go. History goes on and on. And we'll see again in the 9th canto this idea that it comes and it goes and it comes and it goes and it comes and it goes. And there's a little bit of lessons to be learned, but basically everybody's born and dies and born and dies and born and dies. And guess what? You will also. You will be born and die. Don't think this won't happen to you. I went to Thailand. I was in Bangkok. And in Bangkok, there is a ashram, a monastery for Buddhist monks. And it's a beautiful place. It's right in the middle of Bangkok. It's gorgeous. And it's 90% man-made. So you walk around a corner, and all of a sudden, from the roaring city of Bangkok, you're entering into a forest. And there's big rocks, there's a 60-foot waterfall, there's all kinds of things. And each monk has a little hut with a lean-to kind of roof, no walls. And they're only allowed to have what they can fit in that hut. So they put things kind of in the ceiling, in the rafters. And you can see everything. So it's a nice place, but all the rocks and the waterfall and most of everything else is all man-made. It's all fake. But they live there, and it's very beautiful. And you go up this spiral ramp all the way to the top, and there's a coffin there. The lady, there was a woman who donated the money that was required to build this oasis in the heart of Bangkok. Because as soon as you enter it, there's silence. When you're outside, it's like noise, like crazy. But when you enter this place, it's like automatically everything becomes silent and still. It's a sanctuary. So at the top of the sanctuary, there's this glass coffin. And inside the coffin is this woman. And she's really old. She's been there a long time. And she is, you know, what happens to dead bodies in coffins. But you can see it because it's glass. And there's a sign on it that says, don't think this won't happen to you. That was her final message. the end of everything in the material world is this, you know, leathery, wrinkled, no teeth, eyes gone, and everything shriveled up. That's what's going to happen to you. So we hear this again and again as we go through the different manus and what happened again and again, and we'll see that again in the ninth canto. And then we focus in on one particular little situation, on one particular son of one particular manu and his son and his son. And we're somehow introduced to Indra riding on his elephant, coming in contact with Durvasa Muni, getting a garland, mistreating that garland due to his arrogance, and then being the demigods being cursed. Now, what happened as a result of that? The demigods lost all their wealth. Indra lost all his wealth, and him being the king, everybody lost all their wealth and all their auspiciousness. Everything became kind of black. So they were in distress, they were disturbed, and ultimately they went to Lord Brahma, not ultimately, but on the path to ultimately, they went to Lord Brahma and said, "We're in trouble, what should we do?" But they didn't say, "Indra made a mistake. Look at that guy, he really screwed things up. Now we need to have some kind of intervention here. Maybe we should get a new Indra, because he blew it." They didn't mention Indra at all. They didn't mention the problem that he created at all. They didn't blame anything on him. They said, "We have a problem. We need to work together to fix it." So there's a lesson, right? If we can, we are in an international society for Krishna consciousness. And in case you didn't notice, sometimes we make mistakes. And sometimes people come to me and they say, "Well, what was it like in the good old days when Prabhupada was here?" As if when Prabhupada was here, we never made mistakes. But we made mistakes when Prabhupada was here, big mistakes. And Prabhupada went on and on and on, helping us repair the damage done, very often hardly saying anything to the person who made mistakes, or very briefly saying something to the person who made mistake, and then dealing with the issue and moving on with the ultimate purpose of spreading Krishna consciousness all over the world. He didn't dwell on the "you idiot" part. So although Indra was, you know, he was arrogant, he was foolish, he made a mistake, it caused the demigods a lot of trouble, no one said a word about that. You don't hear a word about it again. You just know because the Bhagavatam tells us that that's the cause of this whole thing. So they go to Brahma, and Lord Brahma, he hears the thing and he's a little bit disturbed, but then he goes into meditation and he becomes aware that what he should do is go and see Krishna. Take all the demigods and go see Vishnu at the shore of the milk ocean. So they do that. And then there's all these prayers which are, we've been reading for the last, I don't know how long you've been reading them, but I've been here a week and we've been reading them for the whole week that I've been here. So we've been reading them for a while because we go through it verse by verse by verse. But we shouldn't lose the big picture here, that these demigods are united together in a mission. And their mission is for the welfare of the universal creation, of Brahma's creation. They want to do the best for everybody. Sure, they'll get some perks, as we heard from Ramapad Swami. They're Sakama devotees. They have some material desires, save our back, you know. And we learn from Vishnu, from Indra over and over again, that he has a little attached to profit, adoration, and distinction. He gets nervous when people interfere with the possibility of him being seen as king of the demigods. But at the same time, there's respect for the mission and respect for the place of everybody. This letter that I was telling you about that Srila Prabhupada wrote, he wrote to this president who was probably not following anything. Or maybe he was following some of the four regulars. There's a chance because he was in India. But Prabhupada speaks so strongly at the beginning how I have to respect you. He calls him your divine grace. He said, because you were put in that position by the Supreme Personality of Godhead, the king or the leader is the representative of God, and therefore I have to see you as such. And therefore you have an obligation You have an obligation. And he signs the letter crying alone in the wilderness. He says, until you respond, I am simply crying alone in the wilderness. A.C. Bhaktivedanta Swami. So he dutifully offers respect. And we see in the Mahabharata, right, Vidura was of a lesser birth, so to speak, than Duryodhana or Yudhisthira and the Pandavas. But Vidura was a Mahatma. And he was actually very, very, very wise. I learn a lot from Vidura. Vidura is a mentor of mine. And one thing I learned from him is that although he was serving Duryodhana, and Duryodhana was doing many very stupid things, he never went on the internet. He never got on the, you know, stood on the mountain and said, hey, guys, let's take this guy down. You know, look what he's doing. He knew Krishna would take care. He worked quietly to make things better, to make things best, to help afford change, create change. But at the same time, he did his part to support the leadership because he knew that leadership was there because Krishna had put them there. And Prabhupada also, we see in Prabhupada's example that he was very supportive of the people who were deputed to run things. And at that time we were running things, we were 19, 18, 20. We never had a bank account. Most of us never had a car. You know, everything we owned was in one rock backpack or duffel bag or whatever. And I remember when I joined, when I went to Chicago, I was in the Chicago Temple for a while. It was an old YMCA. And there was a swimming pool in that YMCA, an Olympic-sized swimming pool, which became what? Does anybody remember? Was anyone there? Archita, were you there? No? It became, you were there? What was it? What was the swimming pool? Do you remember? But then it wasn't a swimming pool. It was a second-hand store, right? It filled up from the 8-foot deep to the 1-foot deep with people's junk. You know, whatever we had when we joined, it was hardly worth anything, a few pairs of pants, a broken this, a piece of that. And it all went in the swimming pool. This whole swimming pool was filled with what devotees gave up. In New York, we had a closet. It was called the Maya Closet. We would fill it with whatever, you know. If you needed a pair of socks, maybe they didn't match, but didn't really matter. You just went in and you got what you needed from the Maya closet or from the swimming pool. So we weren't very sophisticated in our management structure. Now we've become much more sophisticated. But here, these people, they're very sophisticated. And still they're making mistakes. Still Indra is making mistakes. And still they're uniting together in order to fix it, in order to make it better, in order to make it best. And what are they doing? They're taking shelter of Krishna. They look inside, they see, we don't know what to do. It's beyond our capacity. What should we do? We should pray. We should ask Krishna what to do, and he'll guide us. And Krishna's guidance is very interesting because Krishna gives them a very humble order, right? Just make a truce with the demons. What? Make a truce with the demons. And again, you know, when they want the head, give them the head of Vasuki. When they want the this, give them the that. Well, just back off. It'll all work out okay. And ultimately it does. And we see in the history of our ISKCON movement that when we unite together against an outside force, thank you, we succeed. Krishna helps us. Lord Chaitanya helps us. When we unite together against the outside force, we are powerful. We are united and we are moving on behalf of Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, on behalf of Srila Prabhupada, and nothing can stop us. And as soon as we're not moving against an outside force, we're moving against each other. And then we stop each other. We don't need anybody else to stop us. Right? United we stand. Divided we kill each other. So we learn from these stories how we are supposed to behave, how we're supposed to act together, how we're supposed to approach the Supreme Lord with a prayerful mood. And we also learn another thing. which I think is probably the most important thing, is that Srila Prabhupada is the most important aspect of our reading his books. There's one very nice verse. It's actually from the discussion that Yudhisthira Maharaj has at the Lake of Death. In the Mahabharata, there's one incident when the Pandavas are out in exile. They come, they're very thirsty, and they come, they see a lake from a tree. They go up a tree, see a lake. And Yudhisthira sends them one by one to that lake to get water. But one by one, they don't come back. And the reason they don't come back is because one yaksha starts to say, don't drink that water, answer my questions first. If you don't listen to me, you're going to die. And they say, well, who the hell do you think you are? I'm a big kshatriya, don't mess with me. And they drink the water and they die. So finally, and this happens to Bhima, and it happens to Arjuna, and it happens to Nakula, and it happens to Sahadev, and finally Yudhisthira is getting worried, where is everybody? He goes to the lake and he thinks, you're very special because you were able to kill my four brothers. I owe you my respect and I'll certainly answer your questions. And one of the questions, at the end of all the other questions, we all know that he said, what's the most wonderful thing? The most wonderful thing is that the living entities watch death again and again and again, but somehow they think, I'm never going to die. But there were other questions after that. And one of them was, what's the news? And then, where is the truth hidden? Where do I find the truth? And Yudhisthira answers that the truth is hidden in the heart, or in the heart of the devotee, in Mahajana Yena Gataksapanta. That the truth is hidden in the heart of the devotee. You can't learn the truth by just reading books, by becoming a scholar, by looking at things from all different angles and analyzing them upside and down and getting a good education. You can't learn the truth that way. You have to learn the truth from a self-realized soul, Mahajana Yena Gataksapanta, because in that pure devotee's heart is the key to the understanding of how to make spiritual advancement. That's why we need a spiritual master. And that's why we need Srila Prabhupada's purports. So if we have to be careful, I was saying, and I think I got distracted, that when we're reading the 10th canto in the Alachua, many devotees, they go to Google Guru. Because we're reading, you know, these stories, and they're long, and they don't have purports. Some of the purports are one line long, and what do you say? You know, you're in front of an audience. There's 135 Prabhupada disciples in Alachua, and, you know, even though their faces are in front of you when you give class, you know they're lurking somewhere on the internet, and so you're in a position where you want to say something new and exciting. You know, so you look at Google Guru and you get something off some Purana somewhere or other, you know, Garga Samhita, some. And so you come up with all these stories and all these far out, this is connected to this by the knee bones connected to, but these stories are uncharted waters. You're swimming in waters where you don't have a captain. You don't have a captain because Prabhupada is not taking us in those places. He's not emphasizing those things. He's not bringing us to those places. So if we enter those places, we have to enter them very cautiously and seek guidance from the purports of Srila Prabhupada's books, because Srila Prabhupada knew what we needed, knows what we needed. And even now, there are others who are offering us ways to get through the Bhagavatam faster, shorter, I don't know what, ways to get through the Bhagavatam and, you know, let go of Prabhupada's hand. Go by my direction instead. But we can't do that because Prabhupada saw us and looked in our hearts, looked in our lives and prescribed everything exactly according to our disease. Exactly according to our disease. The Bhagavatam originally written, the Vedas originally written for people who had different diseases. They were in different places spiritually. You know, mode of goodness. What's the mode of goodness when you're stoned every day? And, you know, and now we're looking at different challenges, and we have to meet those challenges in different ways in order to give Krishna consciousness, but we have to hold on to Srila Prabhupada's prescription, because Srila Prabhupada's prescription was written for this particular circumstance. This, and not the circumstance 1970, now it's all the way in 2014, it doesn't apply anymore. No, for the next 10,000 years, he's giving us the guidance in this Bhagavatam through the teachings of the Acharyas, and he's taking us step by step by step by step to understand how to achieve the perfection that we all desire to go back to Godhead. So I'll stop there because I have meetings and Archita has his hand up already. I didn't even stop speaking.
Some of these devotees may not know that you're here for the strategic planning initiative meeting. So this is the number one strategic initiative, holding on to Srila Prabhupada. Because there are those in our society, like you said, who say, let go of Prabhupada's hand, but hold on to my hand. I'll take you. Who are you? If I had to choose between, like one person says, I mean, I'm not going to name any names, you probably know, that when Prabhupada is speaking Shastra, yes, but then when Prabhupada gives his opinion, that's just his opinion. But even if you say so, if I have to choose between your opinion and Prabhupada's opinion, whose opinion am I going to take? Yours? So thank you very much for this. Thank you very much for this. It's so important. I mean, we're all going to be gone pretty soon. It's more important for these other devotees coming up behind us that they know they have to hold on to Prabhupada, not so-and-so Swami and this other one from over there. Prabhupada. To the extent that somebody's giving you Prabhupada, to that extent they're important. Otherwise, forget them. Hare Krishna.
Hare Krishna. Yes, Prabhu. I think we need to get the microphone. There's someone traversing the path of the Mahajans here.
Thank you, Mataji. That was very nice, wonderful. How do we deal, or what advice can you give for many, for the new devotees and myself, that we worship Prabhupada, we love Prabhupada, we accept everything, as we said, still sometimes some people join and eventually, apparently, they might divert a little bit and they have some love for Prabhupada, but not in the same way as we might have it. So how to deal with them at the same time, like remaining Vaishnavas, not, you know, like fighting back and forth, and meaning like remaining respectful and strong in our, without shaking in our faith with Prabhupada, but still, they still have some ways that they encourage them to keep going.
The greatest encouragement that we can offer is to become impeccable in our own behavior. That when we are functioning at an optimum level, when our relationships with the friends of the family are strong, when our sadachara, our inter-Vaishnav behavior is wonderful, when our temple is clean, when the deities are happy, when we're enthused to give Krishna consciousness to others and practice Krishna consciousness strictly, then we speak for ourselves. We don't need to argue. There's no need to argue. Different people come to spiritual life looking for different things. And not everybody is looking for Krishna. I was once, 1969, I was in Buffalo, and one devotee said to Srila Prabhupada, we were talking, several of us, and Prabhupada was talking about how if you came to Krishna consciousness, or came in contact with devotees, it must mean that you were a devotee in your last life. And this devotee said, well, that's Srila Prabhupada, does that mean that I was a yogi in my last life or practiced some yoga? Prabhupada said, well, some people come by mistake. But the ultimate purport is that some people are looking for something else, and they're going to find something else. You see, even the demigods here, they weren't looking for pure devotional service. They didn't find pure devotional service. They got Krishna, but Krishna took care of the big situation. If you look at Ambarisha's problem with Durvasa, you see a very different scenario, right? That Ambarisha had a run-in with Durvasa. Durvasa was offended. Durvasa tried to curse him. It didn't work. And Krishna protected Ambarish himself, the person, because Durvasa was trying to mess with the devotee. In the situation here, you see some demigod, Indra, acted improperly, and Krishna intervenes, but the intervention is an intervention on behalf of all the demigods for the welfare of the world. It's not just that he taught Indra a lesson, although he tries to do that again and again, but somehow Indra doesn't always get it. But really, Prabhupada would rarely, except in very closed circles, waste time arguing over a particular philosopher, a particular group's trip. He just wouldn't go there. So if somebody, professes, and I have to say professes, because if they loved Srila Prabhupada, they would help him in his mission. And what I see is that they don't help him in his mission. Actually, they try to fractionalize his mission, which is not a sign of love. It's a sign of something else. You can judge love by action. Words are cheap. Anyone can say, I love you. You can buy cards, Hallmark cards, that say, I love you. You know, every year they sell millions of them. But that love is just empty words. It doesn't mean anything. Love is shown, by Prabhupada said, by how we will cooperate together after he's gone to push this movement forward. That's love. So if I love Prabhupada, then let me roll up my sleeves and get behind his mission and not only preach it to others, but live it, practice it, and make the International Society for Krishna Consciousness glow. Because when it glows, people will be attracted to its glowing. And then we don't have to say anything. We just have to do. So then when we come in contact with these people, we can certainly be respectful, as we hear in the Nectar of Instruction. Offer obeisances or fold your hands, you know, offer some respect. But more than that, we don't need to do. We don't need to do. And we find again and again that, you know, if we extend a hand, oh, come take a feast or whatever, then they take a mile. And then we wind up, like, wondering how to get them out because they're taking advantage. And that's also not a sign of love. So we have to, you know, be honest with ourselves and with them, and we have to set a proper example. I think really, other than that, there's not much we can say. It's just like getting on an internet dialogue, you know, someone says something and you feel impelled to respond. That's your first mistake. As soon as you do that, you're in this endless loop of garbage that goes back and forth, and you can't win because people aren't, it's not worth it. Just hang up. That's the best thing to do. Hit delete. So, so I think our example is probably our best source of defense. You're welcome. Hare Krishna. Anybody else? I have to end. So thank you very much. Hare Krishna. All glories to Srila Prabhupada. Hare Rama.
Well, after